Blog Talk Radio.
This is the UR Tennis Network. We are the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate tennis enthusiasts who promote our sport relentlessly. We strive continuously to bring news and information for players, parents, coaches, officials, businesses, and anyone else who loves tennis. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis may not be interested in them.
Started with hanging posters on my bedroom walls. The battle rapping for status up in the schoolhouse. Just call me Double Sushi, thought I was too raw. And hip hop was my home, I had my shoes off. 6'3 in high school, skip a hoop dream. If I don't blow up, then maybe I'll try the school thing. I went to college to do my family a favor, but I couldn't pick a major cause I wanted to be major. I tried selling work, but it didn't work. So I worked, chopping center cart, finna go berserk. Lunch break, see me writing 16s over Mickey D's. Skipping class, making beats over keys. And I love it even though I'm just chasing. Selfish ambition, couldn't tell your boy Nathan. Watch out all you rappers cause they finna let crank in. But I was sleeping on the sun like the day's in. And you can have the money, and you can have the fame. For me, I want the glory. I'm living for the name. See, life is just a picture. I see outside the frame. I'm living for a kingdom that I ain't never seen. Yeah. And I'ma take that. I'ma take that. Find a key to life and best believe that I'ma break that. Glory, I'ma take that. I'ma take that. Glory, I'ma take that. I'ma take that.
Quiet, please. Here comes the chair umpire.
And now, introducing the umpire of today's match. Hailing all the way from Burnett, Texas, and representing college coaches everywhere, the only one we could find to call the match, Jason Haynes! The show will be the best 2 out of 3 sets with tiebreakers, and is called Diversity in College Tennis. So turn on your phones and get ready to call in.
And I'ma take ya, I'ma take ya. Find a key to life and best believe it, I'ma break ya. Glory, I'ma take ya, I'ma take ya. Glory, I'ma take ya, I'ma take ya.
Good afternoon to all of you tennis fans. This is the UR Tennis Network. My name is Jason Haynes, and I am the host of Diversity in College Tennis. It's an exciting hour and a half long show that interviews the college tennis coaches from all across the United States of America and lets them tell their story. It lets them tell their story of them personally as a coach, the story of their program, and also reflect back on some interesting questions about American tennis. So we're looking forward to today's guest. He is Coach Michael Hunt. He is from Texas Lutheran College. Michael and I have been friends for a long time, and I value his opinion about the college tennis. He has a variety of experiences here that he's going to share with us as we travel through today's episode. He'll be on at about 2:20, which is about 20 minutes from now, and look forward to speaking with him. There's a lot of information that is coming out of the college tennis world. We are officially into the spring season, which is the dual match season. That's an exciting time for college tennis coaches, a time where their team is returning from winter break. You hope that they have hit some tennis balls while they were at home. A lot of them probably crammed in the tennis after January 1st got here and have hit a few times. And I was speaking to a college coach yesterday. They had started school and practice, and they were going to meet with a sports psychologist that day. So they were off and going, and that was exciting to hear. The spring season in the dual match format allows your team to play another team, my team versus your team. And on any given day, you can have a hero that was unexpected in a match that might have been unexpected. And that's what always made it exciting. As a college coach, you'd love the 7-0 duels But I can remember the 4-3, the 5-4 battles the most. Those were the ones where you spent a lot of time on court trying to help a young person maneuver through the difficulty that had been placed in front of them and get them to just open their eyes a little bit here differently than what they were seeing and see if we could crack the puzzle. And, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But those are the days I fondly remember. We have officially gotten into the new year here with the UR Tennis Network. We're so glad that you're listening. It is a network of amateur people that are passionate about tennis. We don't know a lot about broadcasting. We don't know a lot about news media or any of that. What we do know about is tennis, and we're hoping that you'll get that through the network. We do offer a variety of shows. Monday morning at 11 o'clock Central Standard Time is Parenting Aces with Lisa Stone. Tuesday is my show, Diversity in College Tennis. Wednesday at 11 o'clock Central Time is American Tennis with Chuck Creasy. Thursday is the Bruce Lipka Show at the same time, 11 o'clock Central Time. Friday at noon is the Tennis Authority with Ms. Natalie Shaleen, who does an outstanding job of getting the tennis industry involved. Saturday we have Minority in College Tennis and with the Mr. Alex Chan out in Virginia. And then Sunday evening we cap off the week with We Coach Tennis with Mr. J.P. Weber, who does an outstanding job of getting just the coaches all from all levels, high-level coaches, low-level coaches, mid-level coaches, you name it. J.P.'s not afraid to talk tennis with any of those people, and we're so excited that he's a part of what we're doing here at the UR Tennis Network. Now, as promised in January, we're looking to expand. We are in talks with several different hosts as we go through this and getting them on board, so your tennis information from the UR Tennis Network will be expanding here very soon, and we're excited about that. And don't think that I forgot that every time I get my show going, I say hello to my mom, Stella Haynes. Stella was one of the first listeners that we had, actually the first official listener. The other listener on that show that day was the radio producer, and I think he had to listen. But Stella has been a big, strong part of this show, and so glad she's listening today, and also officially the first call-in that we had was from Stella, and those of you that are interested in calling into the show today, that number is 714-583-6853, 714-583-6853. We also have an email, which is college, the number 10, the letter S, at gmail.com. That's college10s at gmail.com, so you can interact in the show whichever way you see fit. And as a reminder, some of you, many of you are listening on the podcast that are available at iTunes and Blog Talk Radio, and we're excited for that format that allows you to take us wherever you want to go and listen to us whenever you want to. And we just ask that you tell somebody else about it. Tell one of your tennis friends, one of your tennis partners, an opponent, a youngster, an oldster. Let them know that we are out here at the UR Tennis Network, and we need your help with listeners. And the more listeners we get, the more we'll be able to offer. So very excited about that stuff. Now, as far as college tennis news, I think the big news that's come out in the last week was the releasing of the ITA Division I national team rankings. These are the preseason rankings. These came out January 3rd. And we're going to start with the women's national team ranking first. Number one here, defending champion University of Florida steps in, and they're well represented. UCLA at 2, Duke University at 3, 4, University of Southern California, 5, Stanford, 6, University of Georgia, 7, Cal Berkeley, 8, North Carolina, 9, University of Miami, and 10, the University of Alabama. So it's a heavy-laden field there. I took notice to it that, you know, again here, California does a good job of getting themselves represented out there with UCLA, University of Southern California, Stanford, and Cal at Berkeley. And then second in that group is going to be the SEC, University of Florida, University of Georgia, University of Alabama. And then the ACC with Duke and North Carolina get involved there, with the Big East having Miami, the University of Miami, involved in that. So a lot of good schools involved in that. These rankings go all the way down to number 75. Number 75 this year is the University of Wisconsin out of Madison. And wish them the best of luck in making the huge climb all the way from 75 to number one this year. They've got a lot of great teams in front of them. Just to read off a few here, you got DePaul University, University of Memphis, coming in at number 52, University of Missouri, number 39, Long Beach State, 33 is Pepperdine, 29 is Rice University, going to 23 is University of Tennessee, 18 is University of Mississippi, number 14, Texas A&M University. So lots of climbing to do for the University of Wisconsin out of Madison, and wish them the best of luck, as well as the other teams mentioned, and very excited to get to report on those teams as they progress through the 2013 season. Now, on the men's side of this, and we definitely want to thank Campbell's and the ITA in this. They're the ones that put out the ranking. Campbell's, those little cans of soup must be doing real well in the economy and everything. So we've got them on board with the ITA here to help sponsor this. On the men's side, again, a preseason ranking. Number one this year at the preseason will be the University of Virginia. I guess the loss of Stevie Johnson knocked the University of Southern Cal down to number two in this regard. Must have been a pretty good player for that to happen. Number three, UCLA. Number four, Ohio State. Five, Duke. Six, University of Georgia. Seven, Pepperdine. Eight, University of Oklahoma. Nine, University of Kentucky. And 10, Stanford University. California, again, dominates four schools, and not all in the Pac-25 or whatever they are at this point. You got University of Southern Cal, UCLA, Pepperdine, and Stanford University there at 10. And then it's kind of mixed. We've got the SEC has got some schools. The Big Ten's got schools in there. The Big 12 has schools in there. So not as prevalent a second conference in that versus the California out there with the Pac-10 or Pac-12 at this point. Represented. Now, coming in all the way down at number 75 is Princeton University, and I want to wish them best of luck going 75 to number one as they traverse through this field. Their encounters as they go along from 75 to number one would be teams like East Tennessee State, University of North Florida, St. John's University, Rice University, Columbia University. Number 40 has North Carolina State. Coming in at number 31, Virginia Commonwealth. 26, Texas A&M University. 20, University of Michigan. 15, Baylor. And number 11, Mississippi State. So lots of great teams out there. And look forward to those reports as we go through this year. Now, I want to let you know that on Twitter and Facebook, the UR Tennis Network, we are also a news broadcasting service in this. We try to get as many interesting tennis stories as we go through the day. You can check us out on Twitter at UR10S Network, and then also at Facebook as the UR Tennis Network. Please like us there and follow us on Twitter and get your information from there. We hope to bring you a lot more college tennis stories, as well as other stories as we travel through 2013. An interesting fundraiser that I came across here from the University of Wisconsin, mentioning them at number 75 on the women's side. They held a Serving for Sandy fundraiser up in Madison. The event hauled in over $600 for hurricane relief, and I was excited to see this because the kids put somebody else first in this. You know, it's a difficult time up there, and what happens a lot of times when these storms come in like this, and we're very familiar with this in Texas, there's a sudden outpouring, a rush of relief that comes in, and you just don't know where to go with it and what to do with it, and then they leave. And the people that are up in Sandy or in Galveston or Louisiana, they're the ones that have to clean up and pick up, and I know they're still doing that there in Sandy. And want to wish them the best of luck as they go through this. They had a mixture of young kids, college students, and adults at the Nielsen Tennis Stadium. They competed in tennis drills run by the Badgers as well as played games. The women's tennis team also baked goods for the fundraiser and raffled off a tennis racket. So you see, you can do a lot there for people in a short period of time. And as tennis people, being led by the tsunami relief a few years back, you know, the pros got involved with that. And we love to hear about these types of stories, these acts that show people this isn't news, this is just a straight up act, and this is a way to show people that you've helped out there. So very excited for the University of Wisconsin. I think they should move up the ranking just for that there. They ought to get a couple of bonus points in the ranking system for that. Now remember, that ranking system's done by a computer. So we've taken the human out of it and decided that a machine offers a more unbiased approach into it. And you know, for me, I'd put the University of Wisconsin a little higher with that effort there. Another interesting story is the University of Chicago men's and women's tennis teams have extended themselves beyond the tennis courts to a local elementary school there. The men's and women's tennis teams are going into these schools and helping these kids out, and it's the Andrew Carnegie Elementary School on the south side of Chicago. They've been volunteering in the classrooms that could use help. The idea for the tennis teams to volunteer came from first-year men's and women's tennis coach, head coach JT, who, aside from tennis experience, brings with him a tradition of doing good to the University of Chicago tennis program. You know, the student athletes are giving back here in areas that really need help. The men's tennis team, the tennis team is in classes from kindergarten all the way through eighth grade. Most assist with older students, but some even help out with special education resource teachers. You know, the coach and the people say that the children are just the sweetest kids I've ever met. Every time I come in, they give me a hug. And the teachers absolutely love the kids. Instead of being one teacher and 35 kids, they now have five teachers and break them up into four and help them with their math and spelling and government. And, you know, to give back is truly what tennis is about. You know, we all get information, and to be able to share that information to give back is critical in all of these times. So hats off to the University of Chicago there, and I want to wish them the best as they continue to give back in this sports world. So the other interesting news that I came across regarding college tennis, and some of you may know about this and may not, but there is an interesting story about a college tennis team, the University of California at Berkeley. Their men's team sent its 12-strong member team, plus the coaches and a manager and a support crew, to the Wanaka Open Tennis a tournament at the Wanaka Tennis Club. This is in support of a couple of their teammates. Wanaka is in New Zealand, and brothers Ricky and Ben McLaughlin are members of the team there at Cal Berkeley. Ben is actually Berkeley's top player, and Ricky is the team captain. They welcomed the teammates into the Queenstown Airport and are going to stay there a week, and they're being housed by local tennis families. They had a little trouble getting out there. They had a flight delays in San Francisco. They got to Queenstown at 4:30 p.m. on Saturday, just in time to play matches at 6 p.m. So if you had any jet lag, it was had to be overcome really quick. So what happened was they were unable to get that connecting flight from Auckland, so they spent Saturday night in the hotel before flying to Queenstown at 9 a.m. yesterday morning, and the matches were moved over. None of the players had been there before. and this was their first experience. So last year there were 24 players in the single competition, this year 39, so the 12 boosted it up, and you know, it's a great chance for some of those local kids over there to get involved and give Cal Berkeley kind of a one-up in recruiting and see some of those kids that are over there, and we're excited that they took an opportunity here to support some of their local kids that were there and on their team. I think that's a great idea. Anytime you can get American kids over into the other environment, which is your international's home, then I think that's a great way to go through life and just to give back on a different perspective. A lot of those kids in those international situations have dreams of coming to the United States of America. Some have dreams of living here and raising a family, and for Americans to get out there and just kind of reach out and give back a little bit of what we have is outstanding, and hats off to the University of Cal at Berkeley and their men's team for doing that. So I think I've got Mr. Michael Hunt on the line here. I'm going to play a quick commercial, and then we'll bring him in.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, as I bring Coach Hunt in here, I want to remind you today that the call-in number is 714-583-6853. If you have a question for Coach Michael Hunt or myself, you can do it there, or you can email at college10s@gmail.com, college10s@gmail.com. Coach Michael Hunt, are you there?
I'm here.
Very good. Very nice to have you today. I'm sure that you're enjoying the beautiful weather in Seguin, Texas.
Yeah, actually it's a little rainy today, though. So even though the temperature is nice, it's a little drizzly out.
Right now, have you started school yet, or do you start next week?
We start on the 15th, so about a week from today.
Very good, and the spring season is a great time for dual matches. When do you get started with your first dual match of the spring season?
Our first duel will be February the 16th. We actually don't kick off practice until the 28th of January, which is a little later than most of the D1s and D2s. We'll start off February 16th. We're actually going to play Jacksonville College, which is a new junior college that has just sort of kicked off in Jacksonville, Texas, and we're going to go play them in College Station.
Very good. We've been reporting on the Jacksonville College situation. It's a great situation for a new community to get tennis involved in, and excited that you're going to go out there and help support that program. You know, Michael, as I travel through this college tennis world, you're one of my all-time favorite characters in this scheme of things. But believe it or not, the people listening to my show today, some of them aren't going to know who Michael Hunt is. So can you give us a biography on Michael Hunt?
Well, I've worked hard to keep it that way, Jason. I tried to stay under the radar as best I could. I've been in this game a little while now. I'm in my third season here at Texas Lutheran University, which is in Seguin, Texas, about half an hour from San Antonio. Prior to that, I did 5 years at Western Illinois University, which is a Division I school in Macomb, Illinois. Before that, I was at Sam Houston State for a couple seasons. Here in Texas, Huntsville, Texas. And then prior to that, I was the head coach at Eastern Illinois University. And then before that, I was the assistant coach at Illinois State University. So that's about 11 or 12 or 13 seasons. I'm not sure how many I've done now, but most of that time was in Illinois, but I spent about 4 or 5 years now here in Texas coaching as well.
Well, Michael, I noticed that in particular was is if there's a tennis job opening in Illinois or Texas, people need to look out if Michael Hunt's on the list.
Well, for a while, my goal was to get to all of the directional schools in Illinois. I got Western and Eastern. And then, you know, I actually was a finalist once at Northern Illinois. And then, of course, Southern would have you know, rounded out the list there, but unfortunately, I didn't quite get to make all that.
Yeah, now most of those schools are Division I. Texas Lutheran is a Division III. you know, as you go through this, was that by design, what's your plan here on the Division III? And what I mean by that is you know, it's an entirely different landscape from Division I to Division III. So why
Absolutely.
The transition?
Yeah, well, you're right. I coached Division I, you know, my entire college career, really, and enjoyed it very much. Had some good years, had some success. You know, won a couple conference titles at Western Illinois, made it to the NCAA championships. So, you know, I felt comfortable at that level. I enjoyed that level. And then, you know, once I hit that magic age of 40, which was a couple of years ago, you know, I decided that I wanted to come back home here to Texas, and I am a native Texan. And I think at that point I had kind of tired a little bit of a couple of things, one of which was the I know we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but the international influence in Division I had started to wear on me a little bit, and also just, you know, in general, dealing with scholarships, you know, that proved to be something that I grew to enjoy less and less over the years. You know, a lot of kids, a lot of U.S. kids, it seemed to me, played for the scholarship. And so, you know, once they had earned their scholarship, I saw a lot of kids who just kind of shut it down at that point and weren't interested in really progressing as tennis players. In other words, they had always set that scholarship as their goal in junior tennis. And once they achieved that goal, I noticed a lot of players really didn't progress past that point. And it just sort of soured me a little bit. And I love the Hill Country. I love New Braunfels. Clearly, you spent a lot of time in this area as well, so you know how beautiful it is around here. You know, I wanted to live in this area and give Division III a shot. To be quite honest, it's turned out to be the best decision I've ever made. I absolutely love Division III athletics. I wish I had gotten here sooner. It's been a fantastic experience, and to me, I really feel like this is really the most exciting level of college tennis that's out there right now.
Well, exactly, and I love the fact that you're at Texas Lutheran as well. That community deserved a good tennis mind on its campus. So if we can, right quick, let's talk about that community. You know, a lot of people that aren't from Texas might go look up Seguin and not know how to spell it, but you got to spell it Tequin. No, and so how big is Seguin?
Well, Seguin's about 35,000 people, so it's not an enormous community. We're located right on Interstate 10, it's about, like I said, half an hour from the Riverwalk in San Antonio. We're about 45 to 50 minutes from 6th Street in Austin, about 15 from New Braunfels and the Guadalupe River, and about 20 minutes from your old stomping grounds in San Marcos.
Yeah, it's actually in a great location. It really is. With people that aren't familiar with Texas, shame on you. But there are a lot of Texas coaches that are very jealous of your position, Michael, because of its location. Now, as let's talk about the campus just a little bit. How big is that campus there, Texas Lutheran?
We're about 1,400 students right now. We're in the middle of a campaign right now to get that number up to about 2,000. But we're about 1,400 students. It's an absolutely beautiful campus, just covered with trees, pecan trees, live oak trees. Just a beautiful campus, got a beautiful old chapel right in the middle of it. This is actually our centennial celebration here in Seguin. It's our 100th year in Seguin. We were actually founded in Brenham in the 1800s and then moved to Seguin in 1912. So it's kind of a special year here in Seguin.
Well, I learned something new. Outstanding.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Now, I mean, if you're coming to Texas Lutheran, what kind of degrees are you coming for? Are there any in particular that are really highly touted there?
Well, you know, we are a liberal arts college. So, you know, most of our students do study something in those areas. But our biggest departments on campus are business and kinesiology, believe it or not. Those are our two largest departments. But I think what we've become known for over the years, we have really outstanding sciences here. Chemistry, biology, and physics especially are top-notch here. Chemistry especially is, one of the top schools in Texas. If you want to study chemistry, it's a great place. And then we also have a very strong fine arts department in terms of dramatic media. If you want to study, music education or musical performance, that type of thing as well. So, we're kind of across the spectrum there. Probably the newest program that we have that kind of sets us apart a little bit is we now have a 4-year aviation and aviation management program. So if you would like to fly planes, the big commercial airlines, you can come to Texas Lutheran and learn to do that.
Well, you know, I only really knew of one other program in the U.S. that did that. That was Embry-Riddle out in Florida. You guys have gotten involved in that area. I think that's outstanding.
Yeah, this fall was our first class in that field, and they expect that really to take off.
Nice pun. I like that.
I worked on that all afternoon.
Oh, very good. Okay, so let's talk Texas Lutheran tennis a little bit here.
Sure.
You coach both the men's and the women's team, correct?
That is correct.
And how many athletes total do you have?
That's a floating number. I think right now we're right around 20 men and about 10 women. So we're about twice as large on the men's side as we are on the women's side. I'd actually like to get our women's numbers up just a couple more, maybe get up to 12. I feel a little bit more comfortable with that number.
Right now, and forgive me for this, and I'll just kind of play dumb in all this, but as you go through this, I mean, does a kid just come on the campus and say, I want to play tennis and come see you, or how does that work with the D3 situation?
Well, it works just the same as it does at the Division I, Division II, or junior college level as well. We are out there actively recruiting kids, looking at USTA events, looking at high school events, traveling all across the state. And here recently, we're starting to expand and do a little bit of out-of-state recruiting as well. We are out there looking for kids. We do have a lot of folks that reach out to us as well, and we definitely give them a look and give them a chance as well. you know, I'm someone who wants to give you know, young kids, Texas kids, a chance to play. So even if you know, there's a player out there who isn't sure if they're, you know, quite college tennis material, you know, we'll give them a shot. We'll give them a shot and let them find out what this experience is like and see if it's for them and go from there.
Now, do those athletes or those kids in general there, do they live on campus or off campus, Michael?
I think we're around 90% of our students are on campus. And we have just a few, just here in the last, you know, few years have we started to get some, you know, off-campus apartment complexes being built in the area. But most of our students are on campus. We have, you know, four or five different types of residence halls, including on-campus apartments as well. So there's kind of, you know, a residence hall for almost any type that you would want here at TLU.
Exactly. Now, traveling with your men's and women's team, do you do that a lot? Do you go together or separate, or how does that work in your situation?
We travel almost entirely together. That's, you know, in Texas anyway, most of the Division III schools are coached, men and women are coached by the same person. And so in terms of scheduling, you know, we really do keep the teams together for the most part. We are allowed 20 competition dates a year, which is down from 25 at D1, and I believe D2 has 25 as well. So we only have 20 competition dates, but yeah, we travel all throughout the state. We have played out of state as well. We've taken a trip to South Carolina. You know, we've scheduled matches in Louisiana and Arkansas and some of the surrounding states as well. So, you know, we travel pretty much like any other college team would. Just a little, you know, we just have a few fewer dates than the other divisions.
All right, so let's talk about your schedule a little bit. Let's talk about the fall. How many events do you play in the fall, and where do you go, and who do you see?
You know, we've up until this fall, we've played about three or four events each fall. Our current conference is the American Southwest Conference, or the ASC, and they host an individual championships every fall, a flighted individual tournament, one through eight singles, I believe, and one through four doubles. So we play that event every year, men and women. We also compete in our regional tournament, our ITA regional event every fall, men and women. Those are events are separate. That's one of the few times that we travel separately. And then we've hosted, for 3 years now, we've hosted our own home invitational. It's called the Doc Skogman Invite, and that's here in Seguin. And this past year, we had 16 schools. I believe we have 30 teams total competing here in Seguin. So it's become quite an event. We had Division I, Division II, Division III, NAIA, and junior college teams all playing in that event.
I think that's smart because of your location. You can attract so many different people into your area. Did you do men's and women's in that tournament?
We did men's and women's, singles and doubles. We had... I can't even tell you how many flights we had, but I believe we went from flight A to flight M in the singles. So however many that would be, we did that times two, or times four, I guess. So it was an enormous event, an enormous undertaking. We did it in 2 days.
Oh, my.
And I needed a week of vacation after it was over.
Goodness gracious. I would think so.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, your spring schedule, we've already mentioned when it gets started. As you go through the spring, who do you play? Where do you travel? And how does it end for you?
Well, we like I said, we're limited to 20 dates year long, and since we use three of them in the fall, we have 17 dates. Like I said, we start off with Jacksonville College. We will play all of our conference teams, and our conference includes Shriner, Hardin-Simmons, Sol Ross, Mary Hardin-Baylor, Howard Payne. We play all of, our conference is broken into two divisions, a West Division and an East Division. We play all the West teams, which are the teams I just mentioned, and then the East teams we play, you know, just sort of as we can schedule. And this year, the East teams we'll play include UT Dallas, East Texas Baptist, University of the Ozarks, and I believe that's it for this year. We don't play Louisiana College, Mississippi College, Laterno, or UT Tyler this year. So, and then after that, we play some other schools in the state that are in the other Division III conference in Texas, which is the Southern Collegiate Athletic Conference. And those schools would include Trinity, Southwestern University, Centenary over in Louisiana, Colorado College, which is from Colorado. We play all those schools. We do not play Austin College, which is the other SCAC school here in the state. So we play those schools. We do play some out of Division III as well. We're going to play Prairie View A&M this year. We'll play Dallas Baptist on the men's side. We'll play a few other, Our Lady of the Lake, which is NAIA here in San Antonio. UT Permian Basin will play this year, Division II. So we play out of division a little bit as well. We also have Lewis and Clark from Oregon that's coming down to play us in March as well. So we actually have 21 matches on the men's side, 20 on the women's side. So we double up on a few dates to get to that number. And we think it's a really good schedule. It's going to be a tough schedule, but we think it'll get us prepared for trying to do a little bit better in our conference events.
Yeah, is that the way you finish? Do you have a conference championship and then move on to the national championship? How does that work for you?
Yes, the ASC actually invites four teams from each of the two divisions. So you have to be in the top four to qualify for the conference tournament. And then out of that, the champion of the conference gets an automatic bid to the NCAAs. And then, you know, there are at-large bids available as well. I don't believe the ASC has gotten an at-large bid in a few years. So pretty much the AQ is the way to go to get into the tournament. So, yeah, last weekend of April is our conference tournament. And we feel good about our chances. We feel like we have a very good opportunity on both the men's and women's sides to get to that conference tournament and to make a little noise.
Now, Michael, I noticed that you use some interdivisional play there. Do you think that's important for a school such as yours that you get that interdivisional play, or how do you stand on that?
Well, it helps us in a few ways. First of all, for the most part, when you're playing up in division, you are, playing a little bit stronger teams, and hopefully that's preparing you for the tough matches in your own division, in your own conference. But also it's a little bit of a recruiting thing as well. So, I mean, we recruit against all these schools, whether they're Division III or not. And so for us to be able to talk to a Texas kid and say, hey, yes, we are Division III, but, we played this school here. We played Dallas Baptist here. We played UT Permian Basin here. And either held our own or maybe, got a win, then obviously that can help us a little bit in recruiting as well. And plus it just gets us out to different parts of the state. We want to, part of the college experience for these kids is getting to travel and see places they haven't played before and play in facilities they haven't played before. And so it's all part of that, you know, that overall positive experience we're trying to give to our kids.
Now let's talk about your facility just a little bit. What do you have on campus and how do you utilize it?
We have 9 hard courts on campus. They're broken up into a bank of 4 and a bank of 5. 4 of those courts are lighted. You know, our facility when we got here was 2.5 years ago, was in a little bit of need of work. We were able to resurface 2 of them my first summer here. We hope to get 2 more done this next summer. We replaced all of our windscreens. Now we have logo windscreens everywhere, home of TLU tennis, all that kind of thing. Replaced all the nets. We have all new nets now. So we're in the middle of an upgrade of our facility. In addition to all of our activities, we also our courts are used pretty much year round. During the summer and winter months, Nukes, the John Nukin Tennis Academy, uses our courts for their summer camps. We host events here. We host 2 USTA events here. We host a campus showdown here. There are some other events in the area. The Central Texas Tennis Academy hosts a tournament here. We hosted the Class 3A Team Tennis State Tournament here 1 year, the unofficial state tournament. We're hosting a lot of events, trying to get a lot of people on campus pretty much year-round. Our goal is to, again, get as many people as we can to Seguin and to our campus and, you know, let them see that we've got kind of a hidden gem here.
I think it is, Michael, and I think that they've got the right guy in charge of that program to polish that gym up a little bit. I have a quick little short answer tennis interview here that I give to all my coaches.
So
we'll get through this, and then we'll get into the meat of what we want to talk about today. But I'm curious, when were you introduced to tennis, and who introduced you?
I first started playing at age 6, and I was introduced by my dad. My dad was a high school tennis player, taught tennis during the summers when he was in college. Was a good recreational player, not a competitive player per se, but someone who knew the game and loved the game. And he got me on the courts about age 6. Played my first tournament at age 8. Won my first tournament match at age 11. I think it took me 3 years to win a tournament match, which was a little depressing at the time. But I stuck with it and eventually, you know, got to a pretty good level.
Exactly. Now, is there a phrase or concept that stuck with you from one of those early tennis instructors?
A phrase or a concept? Well, not necessarily a phrase. One of my very first, probably my longest term tennis coach was a man named Tommy Roberts. And Tommy was a man who had played college tennis at Rice University and had played on the pro tour for a couple years with in the era of Tony Trabert and those guys back then. And the one thing that Tommy thought was absolutely critical was the serve. I spent almost 2 years working with him where we did nothing but serve. I tell my kids that now, and they can't believe that I did nothing for 2 years but serve. But it's absolutely true. Learning kick serves, learning slice serves, learning twist serves, all that. We did nothing but serve for 2 years. So for me, I learned early on how important a weapon the serve was and how critical that was to being a good tennis player.
Bet. Now, do you have a great tennis player accomplishment for yourself?
A great tennis player accomplishment? I guess probably my best accomplishment was I played junior college tennis up in Illinois, and in my my two seasons there, I won three regional titles, two in doubles, one in singles, and competed at, you know, at the national event each year. So I guess winning those regional titles was probably my tennis highlight.
But I bet if I had your mom on the show, she'd probably say that tournament win after 3 years of playing was probably the best.
yeah, that was long overdue, believe me.
I got that accomplished. All right. Now, what do you love about coaching tennis?
You know, I kind of love everything about coaching tennis, to be absolutely honest. I'm one of those guys that just sort of eats, sleeps, and drinks it. I work long hours, and I know we all do, but I'm just one of those guys that really can't get enough of it. I love recruiting. I think recruiting is it's obviously the lifeblood of a tennis program, and it's something that I constantly am obsessed with, I guess. I'm working on it all the time, always thinking about my next email or my next phone call. So,
you bet. Now, we're entering into in Texas here. We've got the bowl season mania going on. The Super Bowls were quickly approaching. Is there a tournament at the Hunt household in which you order special food, have friends over, or just kind of clear out the living room and say, do not disturb?
Well, not for pro football, but for many years, I was not able to watch a Texas A&M football game without with anybody else. I was that superstitious that if anybody watched Texas A&M football while I watched it, they would lose. So I used to kick everybody out, and I would be the only person that would be allowed to watch Texas A&M football in my house. But in terms of tennis, of course, I am you know, among the Federer faithful, and I do not miss any of his Grand Slam matches, including in Australia, where you have to stay up all night watching matches on the computer. I do not miss Federer matches and Grand Slams. I have seen, I believe, every match he's played over about the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, Michael, since you mentioned him, and I don't get to talk a lot about pro tennis on here, but since you mentioned him, I'm going to go with this. You know, he's reduced that schedule this year. What do you think about his move as far as longevity goes?
Well, you know, if he's serious about making it to the next Olympics, I think it's a great idea. I'm a little concerned about what that's going to do to his ranking, and that's only important because, you know, clearly, you know, seeding at the Grand Slams, you know, these days has almost everything to do with winning. You know, it's very tough to get through a draw now with having to beat Murray and Djokovic. So, you know, it's pretty critical that he stays in you know, that at least that number two slot, and you know, at least has a chance of having an easier semifinal and being able to save his strength for the final. So, so I'm a little concerned about that aspect, that his ranking might drop out of the top, you know, two or three. But I mean, obviously, I'm thrilled that he's thinking about playing for four more years. So, so you know, hopefully it'll pan out for him.
I agree. I think he's got a great chance over in Australia. I've been inundated with all these exhibition matches as we travel through this with the network, and I think I was having tons of fun down there playing incredible matches, making incredible shots with smiles on his face the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's very good for the game, and the longer he stays, the better we all are.
Absolutely.
Do you have an all-time favorite player other than Federer?
You know, growing up, it was always McEnroe. I was, you know, I grew up in the serve and volley era, and, you know, I sort of patterned my volleys after McEnroe. So, You know, it was definitely McEnroe when I was a player. As I've gotten older and become a coach, you know, probably my all-time favorite player outside of Federer is Steffi Graf. I absolutely love Steffi. Love to watch her play. Just, you know, was able to see her play once in person and before she retired. And so, yeah, Steffi, Federer, and McEnroe probably in that order.
Greatest tennis champion never to use a topspin backhand.
She occasionally would come over it. You know, she hit a couple passes with it, I saw.
Well, so. if you were like me, and first when Steffi came on, I didn't really like her because she's winning all the time and nobody could beat her. And then you start to appreciate the beauty of what she's doing.
Absolutely.
And I would love it when I would see her rip that one-handed backhand.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just didn't do it enough. Now, as since you know, let's just hypothetically speak here for a moment, and let's say that there is a world doubles championship somewhere out there on the planet, and they got this huge draw, and somebody happens to drop out, and they call up Michael Hunt and say, Michael, we'll take you and your ideal doubles partner, past, present, collegiate, amateur, pro. Who would your doubles partner be?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess it's, you know, I just mentioned him, so it's not too too dramatic, but of course it'd be McEnroe, no doubt. I mean, that was the old phrase, right? McEnroe and whoever he's playing with are the best doubles team in the world. So,
well, now, you know, I appreciate that you mentioned that, so I'm going to carry it a little step further here. So what you're saying here is that if John McEnroe and Michael Hunt entered all those years at Wimbledon instead of Peter Fleming, it would have been Michael Hunt with all those titles instead of Fleming?
I think that's a leap you can make, Jason, yes.
Outstanding. You must have some kind of volley, my friend.
Well,
now,
and
last
serve.
Question here
serve,
in this.
You know.
Go ahead. What'd you say?
And the serve. You know, I spent 2 years doing nothing but serving. So
that's right. Now, hardest question. I save it for the last. Now, what is your all-time favorite tennis racket?
My all-time favorite tennis racket. The one I used the longest was the Agassi, the Head Titanium Radical. I used that for probably a decade. But in terms of playing, you know, I love the old Prince Graphite. I love the old Prince Graphite, and you know, I would have used that forever if my arm could have dealt with it. I mean, you know, that thing was a piece of plywood, and it just, you know, just tore up your arm, and I used it as long as I could, and then finally had to move on and get some frames that didn't tear up my elbow and my shoulder quite as bad. But I guess the Prince Graphite for the way it felt, and the Titanium Radical for the one I actually used the longest.
Well, some inside information here, and Prince may not be too excited about this, but they're going to re-release that graphite this spring.
Well, I don't think my arm can handle that thing anymore, but I might get one just for old time's sake.
You know, I ask that question every week on my show, Michael, and that by far and away is one of the most popular rackets that people wish had stuck around.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great frame. It really was.
You know, I've noticed that Wilson with the pro staff, you know, the one that was originally used with Everett and Connors back in the day, through all the technology that we have, is still one of the best frames around when you put it in the right hands, you know, and that's Federer's stick.
Yep.
And I think that Prince didn't do what Wilson did was is keep a good frame, you know, and you got to tweak it. Don't get me wrong. I understand that. But and put it in the right hands. The people.
I agree.
So I'm glad that they're getting back on that edge here a little bit. You know, the head and Babolat here are making real strong moves to compete for Wilson and what was once Prince's territory. Now it's Wilson and Babolat. So it'll be interesting to see competition wise how this all plays out.
Well, if you look at at college players. I mean, you know, I can't imagine that Babolat's not the most used racket. I mean, it's just everywhere. I mean, everybody's playing with Babolat in college.
I would agree, Michael. And don't you think that's because of the Babolat college program?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a super deal for a college kid and some college coaches. When you can get those kids three rackets, a bag, stencil, grips, fluffy white thing to hang on your car, whatever it is, it's smart.
Yeah, and other manufacturers have those programs as well. I don't know why, you know, Wilson, it seems like, has, you know, scaled their programs back over the years, and now it's all dependent upon, you know, how much, you know, X number of dollars you spend with Wilson each year. So, yeah, I think they've probably done themselves a little bit of a disservice, and Babolat's made huge inroads there.
Well, I'm a user of Wilson products. I like that Federer frame.
That's what
I'm with you there. If they don't, you know, you cannot protect areas that other people are involved in. You know, you have to go out and get those areas, and I think Babolat understands that, and they're gonna grab hold of that college market, and Wilson's gonna wonder what happened.
I agree.
Well, listen, I got to play a quick commercial here, and then I'll bring you back, and we'll duke this out on the college tennis and American scene here. Hang on, just a second.
Sounds good.
This is Jason Haynes, the UR Tennis Network's Chief Executive Officer. Over the last 14 months, we have undergone a lot of changes here at the UR Tennis Network, and the Nike Tennis Camps have been one of our strongest supporters. They have had a very successful 2012 summer camp season and now are planning for 2013. We would like to thank them for allowing us to be an advertising avenue for their tennis camps. As we leave the summer, we want to encourage you to check out www.ussportcamps.com and start planning your next Nike camp experience. They have locations all over the U.S. for both adults and juniors. The Nike camps are offered in other sports such as golf, volleyball, soccer, swimming, softball, running, water polo, lacrosse, and field hockey. We want to encourage you to consider the Nike camp experience for your tennis needs. These camps are run by successful tennis coaches and offer a fun camp involvement where you learn new skills and make new friends. Be sure to check them out at www.ussportcamps.com or call them at 1-800-NIKE-CAMP and take your game to the next level.
All right, we're back here on the air, and callers, if you have a question for Coach Michael Hunter, myself, you can call in at 714-583-6853 or email us at college10s@gmail.com. Now, Michael, we'd like to stay fluffy in the whole thing, but that, I don't think that can happen with some of the questions we've got to address here. So, you know, you touched on it a little bit earlier, this international versus national perspective. As we travel through this for American tennis in general, what do you think about it? What's going on out there in the real world?
Well, you know, clearly over you know, the last 15, 20 years, you know, possibly even longer, you know, we've had this influx of international talent into the college tennis scene. You know, as I'm sure many people have said before, there are certainly positives to that. There are negatives, and you know, it's a complicated issue that frankly I've kind of been on both sides of over time. And you know, when I first got into college coaching up at Illinois State in 1997, you know, we did a lot of international recruiting. And you know, when parents at that time would ask me, you know, why do you recruit internationally as opposed to U.S. kids, you know, the stock answer was, well, you know, the kids that we feel like we need in order to be competitive, in order to be to get our program to where we would like it to be, you know, that talent level of an American kid won't look at us. You know, they're looking at a Big Ten school or one of the major conference schools, and at Illinois State, which is a good solid mid-major program, we weren't getting the U.S. kids that we thought we needed, and so that's sort of the perspective that I had for many years with that, and that even carried on all the way through Eastern Illinois and to Sam Houston as well. I recruited very internationally during those years.
When you look at this, historically, you and I can go back because we'll remember these times. Some people won't remember it, but late 70s, early 80s, into the late 80s, American tennis was very, very strong, and a lot of the kids were attending American colleges or had a chance to go to an American college and play tennis and get a scholarship, but then there weren't many internationals on the team. I'm not saying that there weren't. I'm just saying there weren't a lot as far as I was aware of it. And now I draw a relation to this that because we're giving away all of these opportunities to play the American college system to internationals, that American tennis is going downhill in this.
Well, and I mean, I think that's certainly, a valid viewpoint. I think, first of all, international players in college tennis, I mean, go back even further. I mean, Cliff Drysdale, in the 60s, early 60s maybe, played at Lamar here in Texas. Raul Ramirez played at Trinity back in the early 70s, and so I mean, it's nothing new. I mean, it's happened for years and years and years, but in the time period that you and I have been coaching or go back as far as, that's when it really sort of, really proliferated and really became an issue. And I do think that it does, I do err on the side of it does raise the level of at least Division I and Division II tennis. It does raise the level some. It does. I think the college tennis right now is better because of that international influence. However, I do also agree with the fact that maybe our American tennis would develop better if there were more opportunities. So I kind of see both sides of it. But like I said, for me, I've gotten to the point where, the whole mechanics of it just don't interest me anymore. I mean, I was never at a school that could afford to fly me over to Europe for 3 months to recruit, so I did all my recruiting via the internet, via the telephone. And so there was really never any personal recruiting that took place in that. It was all very, impersonal. And going back to Division III, I decided that that's what I wanted. I wanted to recruit kids. I wanted to get to know kids. I wanted to see kids and talk to kids and have a little bit more of a personal experience with them. So for me, I've sort of come full circle. I've come from that, viewpoint of, well, we need the best kids we can get regardless where they're from, to, I want to work with U.S. kids only. And that's one thing we do not work. We do not take international kids here at Texas Lutheran. That's not unusual in Division III. I think a lot of Division III, has become the sort of the safe haven for American tennis players. And I think it's as a result of that, Division III tennis has just grown exponentially in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, now I have noticed that you don't find many internationals on Division III programs. The community colleges put in their rule, their two international roster spot rule. What do you think about that from the outside, looking at that rule?
Well, I think it's a great rule. I think it it you know, the, you know, they originally put the rule in with you could have three on scholarship, and I think that was probably, what, 90s they did that. And then, of course, people got around that by just simply not having them on scholarship or however they got around doing that. Now this new rule is pretty strict. I mean, it's really, you know, you can have two international students, whether they're on scholarship or not, and that's it. So, I think it's positive in that, you know, that will open up some opportunities for U.S. kids. I also think it's positive for schools like mine, who there should be now more American kids coming out of those junior colleges after 2 years looking for a place to go for their junior and senior year. So, while initially, you know, this first couple years, it's going to be a little bit more competitive because we're going to lose some American kids to those junior colleges. You know, hopefully in 2 years we can have another shot at them. So I think it's positive, and it'll be interesting to see if it will have a ripple effect on any of the other divisions.
Do you think that part of this college tennis downfall on that side is we've kind of gotten rid of the American tennis developer and gone after a used car salesman in the college tennis world?
Well, to some extent. I mean, the thing is that as a college tennis coach of two teams, a men and a women's team, the ability, that just the time that it takes to work individually with, you know, in my case, 30 individuals, and to really stress that development aspect, it's just very difficult. I mean, just from a time perspective. So I think I may be one of those used car salesmen. Because, you know, honestly, with the limited amount of time that we had to work with these kids, at least maybe that's a Division III, Division I difference as well. Development is, it takes a little bit of a backseat. It really does. You can work that in as best as you can, but the fact is that, you know, we don't get 20 hours a week with our kids like you get in Division I, Division II. You know, if we get in 15 hours a week, that's pretty good. And so, you know, the time for individual stuff is more difficult. In my program, we do individuals on a voluntary basis, and the kids who are committed and really want to get better, you know, they'll come out and do one or two individuals a week with me. But for me to do individuals, for 30 different kids during a week, you know, it's next to impossible.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Just going to run out of time in the day for that type of development. And I think that was, you know, at Lee, one of the things that we utilized was that we had extra time, we had extra dates, and we would put in the time to get you from point A to point B. And you knew this at Sam, we would take kids that you wouldn't necessarily take because you didn't have time, and maybe after a couple of years they would reconsider that move. And, I always understood that. I mean, I thought it was great when somebody would pick me over, another small school out there, and I'd steal kids from Texas State, and they were going in to play 8 or 9, or kids that maybe just didn't go out of state or something, and then you guys at that level would come in and say, you know what, you've done a good job, congratulations,
yep,
Here's a scholarship.
Yep.
And I'm hoping that this move with the JC really gets the communities in America to realize that, you know, this is easy to do, and this is pro-American, and it's pro-education, and we can support this.
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
Well, now, and the other side of this is as you've traveled through your years of college coaching, do you see more minorities getting involved in the sport?
You know, I do. I don't think that I don't think the growth of minority tennis is maybe moving at the pace that it might be hoped. But I definitely do think that you're seeing a lot more minority participation. I think, you know, depending on where you are, you have different minority groups that you know are starting to get, you know, because clearly here in our area, you know, San Antonio and south of here in the valley, you know, obviously you have a large number of Hispanic kids that are coming up and you know starting to really put out great numbers of not only you know USTA and high school competitive kids, but college level competitive kids. And you know, I would also say that if you know here, you know, I'm just talking Texas now, but if you were over in the Houston area and part of Dallas as well, you'd see there's a very large number of Asian American kids that are growing, and again, you know, getting to those higher levels of tennis competition. So, yeah, you know, it kind of depends on where you are, I think. But yeah, there's definitely successful areas where you're seeing larger amounts of minority participation. Now, do I think it's moving at a satisfactory pace? No, I kind of don't think so. I kind of think that overall, you know, look, now thinking more of a national perspective, if you look at college tennis is still it's a pretty, you know, Caucasian dominated sport that hasn't changed much in the last 20 years.
Oh, you're right about that. It's interesting to note that, and we're lucky to be here in Texas. I've noticed that the Hispanic population is a big contributor to tennis. I noticed late at the end of my deal there at Lee that we started to get more looks from the Asians, even though we were a community college and the Asians value that education. They also saw the free scholarship that was attached to it, and that. Is a big plus in all this for tennis, you know, particularly if you're a female.
Yep.
So let me ask you on this this minority level here, and think about it in this regard. Let's go back in time just a little bit here, and let's look at Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Jackie Joyner Kersee. Let's look at a player like Mia Hamm, or if we had put tennis rackets in their hands at the right time, would they have been great American tennis players?
Absolutely. I think they would.
And so do you think tennis is the hardest sport there is on the planet?
Yeah, I think it might be. not only the most hardest, but with the most barriers to entry. Having to get tennis lessons, having to, you know, sign up and travel to tournaments. You know, it is a very complicated and sometimes expensive process. And in addition to being a complicated sport, and you could, I'm sure there's some other sports out there that would argue they're just as complicated, I think that you're absolutely right that the best athletes in America these days are somehow being diverted to other sports and not necessarily landing in tennis.
Well, I mean, I'll go toe-to-toe with any coach, any person in America that can come up with a reason why their sport's harder than tennis or more competitive or just downright any of that stuff, more physically demanding. And you know, on the men's side, we're hitting the ball. The serves are coming in at 164. At Wimbledon last year, they were hitting ground strokes at 90 miles an hour. They got to cover 79 feet at least, 27 feet across. And you never know what the ball's going to do after it hits the court. And the strategy for each match, each point, each circumstance is entirely different every single time you get out there. So, that'll blow any of the other sports out of the water. I don't care how many people you need to participate in it or what. But and we don't have a clock,
right.
You know. I mean, you look at the Mahut. Isner match is a great example. You know, that five-set battle that went on at Wimbledon, that was 3 days, and all of the world was mesmerized on their TV wondering, what's going on here? Why are they still playing?
Exactly.
Tennis people were like, that's why we play, is because we, we don't have a clock. We don't have overtime.
That's
you know?
Right.
You got to win by two. We'll
that's
keep
right.
going. You know? We'll put the rest of the tournament on hold until these two get done. And so, you know, I feel like that's part of the issue here is that we're not getting or challenging kids to play the hardest sport out there. You know, kind of letting them off the hook here by letting them play a sport that allows you to compete with 20 other people on the field. We're allowing them to put a ball in a hoop and think that's good. I mean, you think about basketball points, Michael, in this. You know, on a good night, Kobe Bryant scores 40 points. In tennis, if I don't score 48 points, I don't have a chance of winning.
That's true.
You know, and Kobe shoots 50%. That's a good night for Kobe at 48 points. You shoot 50% on the tennis court, you're lousy.
Agreed.
You know, a pro baseball player bats 35% of the time. That's incredible. A tennis player hits the ball 35% of the time. It takes him 3 years to win a round in a tournament.
Yep. I'm still living that down.
So, you know, and so what do we do? I mean, is it just a matter of challenging the American family to participate in the hardest sport there is, or is there another avenue here that we're not even looking at?
Well, I wish I knew that answer. If I did, I would have already made a few dollars and a little bit of fame for myself, probably.
Yeah, well, we've got to do something here to get this American tennis situation turned around, and that's going to lead me to this. And you know, what do you think about American tennis? Where is it going? What's happening with it?
Yeah. You know, I think that American tennis is and again, maybe I'm an outlier here, but I think that American tennis isn't quite as bad as the worst you might want to believe. I think that you know, it has become unbelievably more competitive. I won't mention his name, but a former tennis pro, former tennis touring player from the 70s and 80s ran into him recently and was talking with him a little bit, and you know, he mentioned that, you know, today, you know, same road he took to becoming a pro tennis player. He never would have cracked the, you know, he was a top 100 player. He never would have cracked the top 700 today. And I think that's true. I think that, you know, the level of tennis has improved dramatically worldwide, and that, you know, I don't think tennis players, you know, that are playing are any worse. I don't think that we're producing worse tennis players. I just think the bar has been raised so high. And so, you know, the question is not necessarily, you know, what is wrong, but what can we do to to, you know, reach the new bar. I don't think that what we've done has been terrible. I just think that it's, you know, just it's a lot more difficult proposition than it was even back in, you know, the Macaro days. I mean, can you imagine now, you know, the NCAA champion, you know, reaching the semifinals of Wimbledon at you know, age 18? I mean, that would never happen now. But obviously it happened to McEnroe back when he was at Stanford. So, or right before he got to Stanford, I guess. But
all right, exactly. go ahead.
No, I just, you know, so I mean, I think, so when I think about the state of American tennis, I don't think that American tennis is necessarily bad right now. I just think that the bar has been raised much higher, and so it's a much bigger challenge. And to get to where, you know, we have traditionally been, or where we expect American tennis to be.
Well, in that analogy, do you think during our younger years that it was America raising the bar?
You know, to some extent, yeah. I mean, that was at the peak of the tennis boom in America. You know, tennis was at that time, you know, you could argue, you know, one of the three most popular sports in the country. I'd still put, you know, baseball and football up there, but you know, certainly, you know, the amount of participation in general is, I know they say participation numbers are up, but you can just go to public tennis facilities and see, or private ones too, and see the difference. I mean, you know, it used to be impossible to get time on a public tennis court. You know, you'd have to put your racket up on the fence and,
right,
you know, wait, and you know, that's clearly not the way it is anymore. You know, that time period was a golden time, and I'm not sure exactly what is the key to getting back to that.
Well, Michael, we've got about 4 minutes live left on air. I may keep you over just a little bit to finish out these questions.
Sure.
But you know, I got two things that pop into my mind as you say that, and statistically speaking, as we look at the tennis world, it seems to be that those countries that financially run into the issues, troubles, socio troubles, economic troubles, that those are the ones that tend to put out a rash of great tennis players. I mean, Serbia and Spain are great examples of that at the moment. Russia with the women about 10 years ago. Since we currently own $1 trillion debt here in the United States, don't you think that we prosper from that statistic?
Well, you know, again, it's not necessarily the countries themselves, but I think probably more the individuals. You know, if you don't have money, if you come from you know, poor surroundings, poor situations, or war-torn situations, then you want to better your situation, get out from under, and all that. So I think, you know, we've lost a lot of that hunger, a lot of that drive that some of the smaller and maybe less well-off countries seem to have.
Well, I'm going to launch an investigation here on the UR Tennis Network into the conspiracy that it was Bush and Obama that decided to drive the national debt through the ceiling so that we could get better tennis players. What do you think about that?
I think it's a great theory. I think it's a great theory, and I think that guy that was on the Pierce Morgan show yesterday might have some existing evidence there for you.
Yeah, we might have to shift his focus a little bit there. Now, let me ask you this, and this is one I didn't put on the questionnaire, but I'm curious about this since you're an avid tennis fan in this. Do you think that the one-handed backhand is the most dominant shot in all of tennis?
do I think the one-handed backhand is the most dominant shot in all of tennis?
Yeah, now hold on now. Oh, go ahead. You go ahead, and I'll tell you why I asked that question.
I don't think it's the most dominant shot, no. Are you saying the most dominant players in history had one-handed backhands?
I am saying that, yes.
Because I can get to, but I don't think with I don't think that in most cases it was the one-handed backhand that propelled those players to greatness. But I do admit that there is definitely a correlation there between some of the all-time greats and one-handers. That's true. I do agree with that.
Well, I noticed that, and you can confer with me here on the names, but a couple of people that used this one-handed backhand were pretty good. Martina Navratilova, Steffi Graf, Justine Henin, some guy named McEnroe, Edberg, Becker, some other guy named Sampras, and then there was that everybody likes to talk about nowadays, Federer.
And don't forget Laver and Rosewall.
No. Not at all. Not
Margaret
at all, man.
And
yeah.
About a million others, yeah. Yeah, I do recognize the correlation there. I'm, you know, back from my PhD training, though, I'm not sure that we can confirm causality there.
I see. Well, you know, and I think one of Federer's most underrated shots that he uses, and this is why I think it's a dominant shot, is when he rolls his one-handed backhand short into the ad box, mm-hmm. service box, and mm-hmm. draws the two-hander off the court.
Right.
And the two-hander doesn't have a defense for that because there's no reach.
Correct.
And so you can't get anything on the ball, and that allows Federer to set up his forehand, which you and I would probably agree that most of the people we mentioned all had phenomenal forehands, right?
Correct.
Which is just the shot that you saw them finish with, not the shot that they set it up, which was the most dominant shot in tennis, the one-handed backhand. Well, it's always interesting. I'm curious, and I've never asked you that question before, and I like
never
to
have.
Ask friends
have. Yeah.
In that. I believe that we need to teach more of it in America. I really do. I just think it's kind of a lost art form that really helped propel things for us, and I work hard on that with my kids down here at the court. I think I'm the only guy in the United States that teaches a one-handed backhand. My partner in all this, he's a two-handed grinder, and he just looks at me like I'm crazy. But when you get him off the court, I think he starts to understand why I use that shot. So, now, last question I've got here, Michael, and
yes,
you
sir.
Know, and this is Division I experience that you had here. Do you think that college tennis is doing its job? Is it, you know, which job is it doing? Is it contributing to the downfall of American tennis, or is it giving us an upward swing in the pro tennis world?
Well, that's, you know, again, I think that is, you know, I think you could make the argument that that the international influence in Division I and Division II tennis has hurt American development. I think that's, you know, a very fair argument, and I don't disagree with it. I will say that, again, Division III, being the sort of the safe haven now for American tennis players, has the potential to maybe start a reversal of that trend. I really do. You're starting to see a lot more 4-star and even 5-star kids going to Division III schools. You see Emory just getting 4 stars by the dozens, Williams, Carnegie Mellon, you know, UC Santa Cruz. Some of these classic Division III powers are starting to get some of these top U.S. kids. And you know, that's one of the things that's so exciting about Division III for me, is that, you know, it's given U.S. kids and some really good U.S. kids a chance to develop and possibly have a chance to play beyond their college years.
Well, Michael, I hope we can agree on this. When it comes to fundraising for tennis, that the tennis people are the ones that are traditionally the ones that give back the most. And we've done some research on our own here at the network, and a lot of times these Division I schools go to people associated with tennis or golf, you know, to get these huge contributions. So with that analogy there, the Division III programs in America should see a huge financial boost in regards to their promoting, you know, good American tennis.
I agree. And you know, that's another little secret that I didn't discuss earlier when talking about D3, but in many situations, Division III schools have just as good or better facilities and very well-funded programs, very good budgets. Now, certainly not to compare with the top, you know, 25 schools in Division I, but if you look at mid-majors and small Division I's, many cases Division III has better funding and better better opportunities. So, you know, it's one of those little secrets that you don't really know about until you get involved with it.
Well, it makes it interesting, you know, it makes it interesting when you identify, let's just say, two handfuls of Division I schools out there that are actually making money off their athletic programs versus the Division III programs that appear to be rich in tradition, rich in atmosphere, and are getting richer in the pocketbooks because they're catering to these, you know, these kids and such, that maybe we're going about this the wrong way.
Might be. It might be we need to start looking at a bottom-up approach.
Yeah, I definitely think you're right on that. No doubt about it. For sure, Michael. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today. Listen, if somebody wants to get in touch with you through the email, how do they do that?
It's just mhunt@tlu.edu.
Very good. Now, your athletic site there at TLU, why don't you give that out as well?
It's just www.tlubulldogs.com.
Very good. Well, you know, I will see you at some point during this spring, I'm sure. I look forward to conversing with you some more, and thanks for coming on the air today.
I appreciate you having me, Jason. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you so much. Take care.
All right, take care, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That is Coach Michael Hunt. Michael is from Texas Lutheran University there in Seguin, Texas. He is a great tennis coach. He's got a great tennis mind, and he is dedicated to the sport and very passionate about what he does. And if you've got a kid out there that needs a program and needs a good mentor to go with it, then look up Texas Lutheran University there in Seguin, Texas, and you will not be disappointed with all of this that Michael Hunt is doing there. I want to remind you that next week when we come on the air, we've got Coach Paul Scarpa. He's the legendary Paul Scarpa. That's right, 45 years in the business, and he's going to lay it out here and let us know what's right, what's wrong, and what we need to do different. And that'll be next Tuesday at 2 o'clock Central Standard Time. Reminder that tomorrow, American Tennis with Chuck Creasy comes on at 11 Central Time. Make sure you listen to him. I know that he's got a couple of Indiana boys on that show with Coach Lynn Loring and Randy Blumenthal. And then I want to announce that on Thursday on the Bruce Lipka Show is Mr. Todd Martin. So make sure you're involved with that and listen in on that. Thank you for coming on the and listening today, and podcast us on iTunes, Facebook us, Twitter us, all that stuff. UR Tennis Network is here to go. We are the voice of tennis, and we want you to be the ears. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Opinions stated by various contributors to UR Tennis Radio and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Visitors are urged to use their own discernment to draw their own conclusions. All information, products, services, and use of this website is for personal use only. UR Tennis Radio does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of the information contained within the website. Any services or products provided by UR Tennis Radio and its hosts or contributors should be used solely for entertainment and enjoyment. We emphasize the importance of keeping an open mind and not construing the data, products, and/or services as factual.